Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi.
Usually this time of the retreat, I change some of the focus of the talks to start to focus more on insight subjects. The beginning talks of a retreat, I put a lot of effort into trying to give instructions, pointers to developing the mind in still states of samadhi. And it's important to actually develop those still states of samadhi in order actually to gain insight, gain understanding. And one does need the humility to understand that a mind without freedom from the hindrances is always going to be a mind which is covered with delusion. And delusion is something which we don't know is there. A delusion is like a blind spot in our minds. And a blind spot is something which delusion fills in the gaps there, and we don't realize that we're getting it all wrong. But we think we're getting it right, and that is a problem with delusion. It cannot be seen at the time. It's only afterwards we can see just how wrong we are. And the reason why that we are deluded is because the conditioning of the mind, just the way we think, conditions the way we perceive, which conditions the way we think, which conditions the way we view things again. The definition of like delusion in Buddhism, the opposite of insight, this delusion, is well explained by the Buddhist subject called the vipalasas. This is the perversions of our cognitive processes. And it changes and bends the way we view things, the way we perceive things, the way we think things, according to what we want to see, according to our defilements, according to our preconditioned ideas and wants and likes and attachments. And you can see very clearly how that happens by looking at the whole process of the vipalasas, the perversions of the cognitive process. On any stage of this cycle between views, perceptions and thoughts, if you start to say a perception, and as you perceive, so you think. As you think, so that builds up your views. And as you view things, so you will perceive. For example, if you're in an angry mood, you'll perceive things in a negative way. And those perceptions will build up the thoughts and will justify the views. And this is how anger works, or how lust works. If you perceive things in a beautiful way, then you start thinking lustful thoughts, and then you will view things in a lustful way. And that will bend the perceptions towards lust. This is the three vipalasas of views, perceptions and thoughts. It explains why ignorance or delusion, not seeing correctly, why it is so hard to break that cycle. Because as we are conditioned, so we perceive, so we think, so we view things. And we cannot break that cycle just through more thinking, more perceiving, more viewing. Which is one of the problems why people do not understand, do not see the truth which the Buddha very articulately declared again and again and again. The sutta we just chanted, the fire sermon, or the sutta before which we chanted couple of weeks before, the Anatta Lakkhana sutta, or the Dhammacakka sutta, or whatever other sutta, they all have the same sort of inclination. They're all pointing to one and the same thing. And you would think, you would assume, that just the whole weight of Buddhist teachings, just the number of suttas which the Buddha taught, it would be quite clear what the Buddha meant and what the Dharma is. But still, no matter how clear that Dharma is, that still people will filter what they read. They will filter what they hear. And what actually comes out of my heart, which goes through my mouth, which goes into your ears, and which goes into your mind, is not the same. In that whole process, there is a filtering, and we hear only that part of a talk which we want to hear, which fits in to our ideas and views. And we will filter out, even to the point of not even hearing, that which is counter to what we want to hear. And is one of the reasons why that people have arguments on who said what or who did what. It's all because of the filtering mechanism which is performed by the kilesas, by the defilements, which stops us hearing what's being said, which stops us seeing what is written down in the suttas, which stops us understanding what is truth. So be careful when you think you know. Be careful of even your perceptions. What you think is just bare knowledge is not bare knowledge. When that perception arises in any of the senses, including the mind, as soon as that perception arises, it's been through a whole process of filtering. It's been bent by our likes and dislikes, by our attachments. Even our views have been bent. So how can we trust them? We cannot trust them, except if we train the mind in what's called samatha vipassana, sort of the calm and insight, the stillness, the ability to sustain attention, that stillness, and the insight with that sustained attention, being able to penetrate into the nature of things. Really, when we're talking about the sustained attention, the stillness of samatha, what it really means is we're abandoning these five hindrances. And these five hindrances are an important aspect of delusion, of ignorance, of the vipalasas. The Buddha said it's the five hindrances which are the food, the nutriment of avijja, of delusion. And it's a very powerful statement by the Buddha. He was saying that these five hindrances, they build up, they nurture what we call delusion. And it becomes very clear for those of you who know the suttas, who've read and studied what the Buddha said, that it's these five hindrances are the place where we can do something about delusion. It's by extinguishing these five hindrances that we can break the whole cycle of delusion. Because we starve delusion. If you look at the five hindrances of sensory desire, of ill will, of restlessness and remorse, of sloth and torpor, of doubt. If you look upon those and examine them, you can see just how it is that they stop the mind seeing clearly. And a sensory desire is like wanting, so you never actually see or hear or know what's truly there. We only see, hear or know what we want to see, hear or know. Even when it comes to smells and tastes, we only smell and taste what we expect to be there. Which is why that when you have your favorite food, it tastes nice just because you expect it to taste nice. And in fact, the more you build up, you know, the taste of food, you know, the more that you condition yourself to make it tasty, then it becomes tasty. Or the opposite, the more you have ill will towards a food. For example, if I try to give mushy peas to Ajahnana, it always tastes awful to him. Why is that? It's because he's conditioning, where to me it tastes nice. What's going on there? All it is just the conditioning. We're not actually tasting the food, we're actually tasting what we expect to be there. Which is one of the experiences many people have when they go to foreign lands and they start, you know, eating a very strange diet which they never ate before. And when I started to go to, when I started living in northeast Thailand, the food was disgusting and it was terrible to eat. It was all we had, so I had to keep on eating it day after day, month after month, year after year. And after a time, you got to like it. And it started to taste good. And that's a common experience with people, that Now, where is that taste? Is the taste in the food or is the taste in the mind? And very clearly you can see the taste is in the defilements. Because if it was in the food, then no matter how long you ate it, it must always be tasting horrible, always be tasting nice. But it was quite clear that there was something which I was adding, that I was actually bending even the bare perception of food when the taste actually hit my palate. It's the same with smells as well. And I've given the similes before of like some of the smells which I like. One of my favourite smells is batshit. When I was visiting Bhikkhu Bodhi some years ago, there's a whole lot of bats in the forest next to his little hermitage. And I just remarked when we went outside for a little walk, I said, "Isn't that smell beautiful, that bat shit?" And he thought I was crazy. He said, "That's disgusting. What do you mean it smells nice?" And I related to him that for one rains retreat, it was my sixth rains retreat, I spent in a monastery in the north of Thailand where there was a very beautiful limestone cave, and I used to spend many happy hours there sitting in meditation, and there were lots of bats in that cave. It was a very big cave, so I can go to parts where there weren't too many bats, and a lot of the time, if you went in the right times, they'd be very still. They'd be just hanging upside down, and you'd be just sitting in your meditation. Neither was disturbing the other. And because that cave just reeked of bat shit, and it was associated with such wonderful meditations and such a lovely time in my monastic life, to this day, I love the smell of bat shit. And it's a good example of just conditioning. One of my other favourite smells is the smell of tar. And I found out the reason why when I examined was because when I was growing up, I used to spend a lot of time playing soccer in a local park. And in those days, just after the Second World War in the 50s and early 60s, the old metal railings, which were around most of the parks, had been torn down and melted to make sort of tanks and munitions for the war. And in their place, they'd used wooden railings painted with tar to protect them from the weather. And so because these wooden railings were painted with tar and they always had to be repainted every year, and I had such happy memories of playing soccer with my friends and hanging out in the park, and, to this day that smell has beautiful associations. And so to me, the smell of tar, the smell of batshit are beautiful. And anyone who's had trouble with girlfriends know the smell of perfume is just disgusting. It depends on what your associations are, isn't it? So this is actually an example of sort of the way that we perceive. It is completely conditioned, and you cannot sort of justify it as being true and real. And these are bare perceptions which have already been changed and altered. Perverted is the nice word for whipalasas. And so how can we know what batshit really smells like? How can we know what tar really smells like? How can we know what mushy peas taste like? How can we know what the pain in the body feels like? Because even that is perverted by our likes and our dislikes. For example, that we got the heaters on today, and to some people that's so nice to be warm, and to other people that's very painful, it's just too hot. Now what's going on here? Is the heat right or is the cold right? And a lot of times that, again, it just depends on what you really want. A lot of even pain, which we have, sometimes with some types of pain. I remember getting ringworm once on my private parts. And when you scratched it, it was halfway between pain and just this enormous rapturous pleasure. It was interesting, you couldn't really figure out which one it was. Because, it was a little skin infection, which when it was scratched, it sort of, at the time it felt, so good but so painful. It was really weird. And a lot of times, the pains and the pleasures of life. Why is it that sometimes people will go and play sport? And they'll do like marathon runs, which is very, very painful. And you can actually see just the strain on their face. And they say it's good fun, they enjoy it. Or you see, like I remember seeing rock stars, you know, screaming in agony on the stage, and everyone saying it's great fun. So, you know, what is actually fun, and what is... It's just what we add to it, isn't it? What we expect it to be. Even like the first time I had a glass of beer, you know, British beer. It was disgusting stuff. I don't know why people actually drink that stuff. At least that was my perception when I first drank my first glass of beer. I think I was only 13 at the time, breaking the law, of course. And afterwards, I got to like it, after only about a few months. Because I had to like it, because of wanting to change all my perceptions around. So I wasn't actually seeing truth in reality. Just the defilements, greed, hate and delusion, were just bending even bare experience. And later on as a monk, when you started reading the suttas and you started reading the Buddha talking like this, you started to really doubt even just bare perceptions, that I couldn't trust them, let alone my thoughts about what was good and what was bad, what I liked, what I didn't like, even what was true and what was false. It really sort of created such a great deal of doubt in me. And also my views. My views upon Dhamma, my views about what we should do in the monastery, my views about life. All these views which we argue with other people about, and the views which we argue with ourselves about, and we debate with ourselves. Now, how can you actually trust any of these? Now, if you follow that path, you might think that, my goodness, what can you trust in this world? Is it the fact we're not supposed to have any views at all? We can't trust any perceptions, and all our thoughts are all wrong? Even the thought that all thoughts are wrong, isn't that wrong? Where are we going to go? We just get into a muddle. But fortunately, the Buddha actually taught there's a way out of that muddle of delusion. And a way out of that muddle is realizing it's the five hindrances which feed delusion. It's the five hindrances which, if you like, even feed the defilements and make them strong, so that they just bend, you know, everything you can know about the world into being false. It's like, you know, having to look at the world through this glass lens, which bends all the light and just distorts everything, so you can't really see what's there. Or it's like looking in a lake and trying to see the fish or the pebbles in the bottom, and all you actually see, you can't actually see in that lake. All you see is just reflections of the sky, which is why, if you ever noticed on our lakes, that sometimes they look green, sometimes they look blue, sometimes they look grey, sometimes they look white. And everyone knows that water is clear. It's just the reflection of the sky, or in our lakes, because they're in deep valleys, what you're actually seeing is just reflection of the trees on the hillside. That's why sometimes it looks green. So sometimes you look upon a lake, and you're not actually looking at the lake, you're looking what's outside, its reflection. It's not true to the nature of the lake. And you all know that in Buddhism and even psychology, psychiatry, that the lake, a body of water, has always been a symbol of the mind, of the jitta. And so often when we look at the jitta, we're not actually seeing its truth, its reality, we just see it reflecting something outside of it. You know, when there's lust, it just reflects lust. When it's hatred, it reflects hatred. When it's sort of tired, it reflects tiredness. But that's not the nature of the jitta. No more than green, blue or white or grey is the nature of the lake. But why does it reflect like that? For two reasons. One is because it's got waves on the surface, and the other one is because you're not looking in the right place. If you stand right above that lake and there's no waves on the surface of the lake, it's absolutely still, then actually you can start to see deeply into the lake. And that's a good simile, a good metaphor for how to find out the nature of the mind. The first thing always has to be to still the waves on the surface of the mind, which are the thoughts. And it's, there's surface phenomena, thoughts. They're not real. They distort everything. Because they're all coming from our preconceptions, from ideas of what we think Buddhism is, what we think the mind is, what we think happiness is, what we think life is. And that's why you can always argue with the Buddha. Because the Buddha's always right. But because of distortions of our mind, you know, that we can't see what the Buddha saw. So because of that, the first thing, we have to do some samatha, we have to do some quietening down, we have to just allow the mind to come to some stillness, because that restlessness is a hindrance. If there's waves, restlessness there, there's this distortion. Not only is there distortion, but we can't actually look long enough to see what's going on. There's an old simile which I use, which is a very powerful simile. I was just writing it in my little book of stories the other day, of like going up the hillside, up to Bodhinyana Monastery. This was that hillside we've got, from the Southwest Highway up to this monastery. Now, how many times has people actually walked up that hill and walked down it? And how many times have we actually gone in a car? For those of you who've always gone up and down that hill in a car, I invite you one day to walk up that hill. Especially if you've gone up and down that hill many, 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 many times in a car. You will notice what I noticed when I first walked up that hill. That I was walking up a completely different hill than when I was riding up that hill in a car. And I couldn't actually believe what was going on, because I could see different scenery. And then I decided to stop still and just look. And when I stopped still, the scenery changed again. It was the same hillside, but when I was going fast, just the senses just did not have enough time to gather up all the data and to see deeply into its nature. It was just flashes of scenery, that's all. When I was walking, I had more time, so I saw more deeply. The experience was richer and more meaningful, and quite strangely, but quite importantly, more beautiful. When I stopped, was absolutely still, and just stood, my senses had all the time to gather in the data completely. And that was a time when I saw the hillside at its fullest, at its deepest, at its richest. And strangely, it was a time when the hillside was at its most beautiful. And that was a very profound simile for me for how serenity and insight work together. If the mind is moving, especially if it's thinking and rushing backwards and forwards, all you actually get of life is just flashes, like being driven in a fast car. And the more fast your mind is, just the more that your knowledge of life is built up of these very uncertain flashes of scenery. And there's no richness there at all. There's no depth. You just go from one thing to another thing to another thing to another thing, never knowing anything deeply, properly. And that's called delusion. As we slow down more and more, life becomes richer. Which is one of the reasons why monks are happy living in a monastery. Because they slow down. And life becomes richer. Now they see much more, not only into the nature of the forest, but they also see much more deeply into just the nature of life. Because they've got more time to look without running on to the next thing. But standing still represents samadhi, where we get this mind of ours and we actually bring it to a standstill. So we've got all the time in the world to look and to get the richness of things, which is strange, but it's true that when we become still, that things become so rich, they become incredibly beautiful. It's one of the examples of the insight which comes from a still mind, which many of you have experienced, that when the mind starts to settle down and become still, and you have like good samadhi experiences, you go outside and even a blade of grass looks absolutely gorgeous. Just ordinary things just tend to glisten and glow, and their colours are far deeper than they were normally perceived. It's a strange experience that just an ordinary gum leaf, the green is far richer after samadhi than when you're worrying about what you're going to eat today. And this is enjoyable as well. You're seeing deeper into things. There's more fun and happiness. And it's simply because the restlessness is starting to disappear. Remorse is just another way of making the mind move. Sensory desire, wanting, just you're not seeing what's there. You're seeing what you want next. It moves the mind into the future. Ill will moves the mind into the past. And he did this, she said that. And it's a lot of times that these, you know, first two hindrances, they move the mind away from the present moment. If you're not in the present moment, you're not here, how can you be seeing things? These make you run, desire and ill will. And the whole point of stopping these hindrances is settling down. If you had no desire, if you had no ill will, there'd be no reason to go anywhere. You'd stop this running and become still. And it's serenity. That's why these two hindrances, you know, they keep people on the move. When you have desire, you've got something to reach, somewhere to go, something to attain, something which you've got to catch and grasp and keep. Ill will, you've got some other business, something to get rid of. And just too often that we're just always moving. Just I remarked with the Anagarika's novices meeting a time ago that the Buddha said that we're always hurrying and hastening through samsara, blinded by ignorance, fettered by craving. And we're hurrying and hastening through samsara. Nobody actually strolls slowly through samsara. They always hurry and hasten through it. Because if you start strolling and going slower and slower, you're actually getting out of samsara. Because the slower you go, the more you don't cultivate the hindrances, the more you slow down and come to a stop. The more you slow down and come to a stop, the deeper you see. The deeper you see, the happier you are. And the more profound your experience of the mind, life, nature, the whole lot. So if you really want to see, we have to slow down. In the same way that when we want to see into the nature of a lake, we've got to make it still first of all. So there's no waves on it at all. And you can all understand what waves on the surface of the mind are. You're sitting here watching the breath or listening to a talk, and sometimes the mind, there's a wind comes up. You know, the winds of greed or hatred or lust or ill will. the winds of restlessness are the winds of the five hindrances. They blow on the mind and they stop it being still. And when they start blowing like that, there's no way you can actually see the truth. So delusion is like looking at a lake when all the light is bent. You can't see deeply into the nature of it. But what happens when you start to calm this mind down through all these techniques which we teach? You calm it down, let it go, sort of, you know, loving kindness, embrace, just, you know, stop all this controlling, stop all this doing, stop all this complaining, stop all this criticizing, stop all this judging, stop all this thinking. Just stop. When you stop, then the mind stops, the wind stops, then the waves get less and less and less and less and less. I gave a simile a long time ago about when I talk like this about waves on the surface of the lake. You know, in that simile, what most people do, nearly everybody, is actually to get rid of the waves, they try to pat them down and smooth them. They try and make the lake without waves. They just make more waves that way. That's what I mean about not letting go. And sometimes people, okay, they they get the lake reasonably smooth, a few ripples on it, and then they put the hands in to smooth it out. In this simile, it's when they get Nimitta coming up, then they've got it really smooth, just a few ripples left, and then they put their hands in and try and grab hold of the Nimitta and try and make it sort of still. You can't do that. You just make more waves in your mind, in your jitta, in the lake. But if you have that understanding of how to let go, so there's no winds blowing, and there's no winds whipping over the surface of the lake becomes smooth. There's no waves, there's no ripples, it does it by itself, because that's the nature of a lake, of a body of water, to be still. It only starts to move because something outside of itself makes it move. And once it's absolutely still, then you can actually stand on over it and you can look inside. If you stand over it, you don't see the reflections. You actually look deeply inside, and if it's absolutely still, that's where you start to see the fish and maybe the other animals which live in that lake, in that jitta. You start to see the nature of the jitta. And if you're very, very still and look for long enough, maybe you can see right to the very bottom of that lake. You can see all the gravel and the stones and the pebbles on the bottom. And that's adapting a simile of the Buddha, of what insight and understanding is all about. It's seeing deeply into the nature of the mind. But one has to get that quietness and that silence first of all. Because otherwise you don't see what's there, you just see the projections, what you add on to things, how you bend things. So in order to actually to gain insight, real understanding, our job should be to get rid of these five hindrances. Find a means of letting go until these five hindrances completely disappear. And after a while of meditating, of restraining the body, speech and mind, keeping precepts, meditating, developing loving kindness, making merit, all of these practices, after a while, they lead to the subduing of the hindrances. They get less and less strong. There's hindrance of sensory desire. There's nothing much to have sensory desire on in this monastery. We don't have movies and televisions. We don't have parties and nightclubs. The sensory desire is very subdued in this monastery, which is why when sometimes monks go outside of this monastery and see what the real world is like outside, that sensory desire can really come up. One of the places I really hate going is in shopping centres. Sometimes I have to go in those, to go to the travel agent to get the tickets to go overseas or whatever. And those shopping centres are just full of just such harsh images, to my sight and to my ears. Just everything is shouting out, look at me, smell me. You go past the food halls, taste me, eat me. And it's just such a harsh input. And that's how most people live. In our monastery, our sensory desires are very subdued naturally. And because of the routine over here, spending a lot of time in solitude, we're not so stirred up by each other so much. And having only one meal a day and just keeping the breakfast simple, and we try not to stir things up too much. And when you don't stir things up so much, that you've got a good chance of settling sensory desire down. Just for the time you're in the monastery. And if you can do this in the monastery, you've got an opportunity. You've got a window to be able to calm these five hindrances down so much that it might just happen that as the average level goes down and down, sometimes there might be just a special trough, a special low, where for one reason or another, and that time the five hindrances are just extremely quiet. And gives you just the opportunity to abandon them completely for a few minutes. to peek behind the curtain of the five hindrances and actually to see what it's like, what life is like, what the mind is like when the five hindrances aren't there. So actually to have these vipalasas of view, perception and thought, sort of the vipalasas which bend them, no more bending it for a few moments. So view becomes pure, perception becomes pure, thought becomes pure in those few moments when there's no hindrances coming along. What I'm saying there is that because there's no desire and ill will, because there's no restlessness, because there's no sloth and torpor, because there's no doubt there, because there's the first two hindrances, there's no bending of perception and what I want to see or what I don't want to see. But the mind is still, so you can actually look long enough to see into the nature of things. It's clear and powerful because there's no sloth and torpor. And there's no doubt there. You can actually trust this moment. And that gives you the opportunity to see deeply into the nature of things. And that's why that all insights, the real ones, the ones which stop delusion, always happen in those moments when the five hindrances have been subdued. And again, in a retreat like this, the sign that hindrances have been subdued is when you go outside and everything is just so peaceful and quiet, and just the trees just glow. Just even the bricks on the walking path, they're just so beautiful. The mind is still and it tends to bore into things. And just one thing just grabs your attention so long because it delights the mind. Things become, or rather the mind becomes still, because even one thing, just, you know, the glass, your water glass, becomes such the most beautiful thing in the world, and it opens up to you. It's a sign that the five hindrances are gone, or at least very, very weak, so the mind can do amazing things. This is where like meditation becomes interesting and fun. And you start to see the world in ways you never imagined the world to be. Ways which contradict what you thought was common sense. Rather, it contradicts your preconditioned ideas of what things are. And you can start to see, as one of my stories, of seeing the concrete floor in Wat Nanat Chart, which unfortunately has now been covered with plastic tiles. But underneath those plastic tiles in the hall of Wat Nanat Chart, it's amazing, beautiful concrete. So I remember seeing that once when I was walking meditation and the hindrances sort of stopped for a while. And you could actually see just so deeply in to that concrete. It became the most beautiful piece of concrete I'd ever seen. Not just the most beautiful piece of concrete, one of the most beautiful pieces of art I'd ever seen. And again, experiences like that contradict all you were taught before about concrete being ugly. Perhaps that's why, as a building monk, I used to like concrete trucks. And people thought I was crazy. You know, why do you like concrete? I mean, that's really ugly and disgusting. You know, who told you that? It's just a preconceived idea, isn't it? When the five hindrances disappear, you look upon a piece of concrete, and my word, that's just so wonderful. You can actually see deeply into it, and it sort of changes. And when you can actually do this to a piece of concrete, imagine what it's like to do that to your mind or to your body. When you look at this body, you're not seeing what you've been told to believe about this body. Either it's very, very beautiful, wonderful, or you've been doing a super gamma tide, it's just the ugliest and it stinks and all that sort of stuff. Both are wrong. You're just going on what other people tell you. You've just been going on instructions. Again, on others' ideas. You're not seeing it for yourself, in its truth and its reality. But when the five hindrances are gone and you don't know what to see, you're just seeing it with a really open mind, a mind which has been opened by the hindrances. Nivarana means closing. It's like something which is not opened. Vivarana is like to open something up. And I think Awarana, I think, is closed, if my Pali is correct. It's probably wrong, but never mind. Niwarana means like something which is closed and obstructed. That's why it's a hindrance. You're having really an open mind in the true sense of the word. Niwarana is the things which close the mind off. And when the mind is really open, it can see into the nature of things. And so you start to see into the nature of your body. And of course, what you actually see is just body, that's all. It's just four elements. It's just, you know, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin. It's just a bag with just all these things inside. It's not beautiful, it's not ugly, it's just body, that's all. It's my body, your body, the most beautiful woman in the world's body, the most strong, handsome, whoever turns you on, man. The ugliest woman, the kids, kangaroos, centipedes, whatever it is. Just bodies, that's all. Just bundles of four elements. Just khandhas, that's all. But to be able to see that, you have to actually, to see it properly, not what you expect to see, not what you've been taught to see, you have to suspend everything, because that's what the serenity does. It stops the mind. And especially it stops it from the past, so it cannot pick up anything of what you've heard before, anything what you've been taught before. All of those ideas, conditions from the past have been stopped and halted. So it's the time when you can really see things with an open mind. Free seeing. And then you start to look upon this mind. And of course, there's people who've got all sorts of theories about the mind. And even you read the suttas, you've got all sorts of theories of the mind, what the jitta is. You know, whether the jitta after death is going to be like this or like that, what an arahat's jitta is, what anyone's jitta is. But you know, all those arguments which people have, what are they? Just but theories. And just like speculations, if the five hindrances are still there, you can't trust those ideas. Even if you read them from the suttas, and it says here, black and white, the chittas are like this. Okay, this is what the Buddha said, but is that what you're seeing? Or is those ideas being bent before they reach you? You can't even trust what you see and what you read. The Buddha, what he said was absolutely true. But by the time it gets into your mind, there's been so much filtering going on. You can't even trust your idea of what the Buddha said. You can't trust your perception of what the suttas say. You can't judge your thoughts about the Dhamma. You can't trust those things because the five hindrances will bend the whole thing around. But when the hindrances are gone, if you pick up the suttas then, after a very powerful meditation, when the mind is clear, and you forgot what you're supposed to interpret the suttas as, you know, you forgot all your old ideas of what you worked out in the past, and all your old insights, some of the best insights you've ever had, are not available to you. You just see what's there, fresh. Not adding anything to it, not expecting anything. Only then can you actually have that open mind of courage to see what you don't expect to see what you don't want to see, you know, to see beyond, you know, your likes and dislikes, and to be able to see that long enough with stillness that the whole thing opens out to you. That's why sometimes you can read those suttas in just one passage. Can blow you away for hours, for days sometimes. We've just been chanting the Adita Pariyaya Sutta, the fire sermon. And you should know, that all those 1,000 monks, they became enlightened after hearing that sutta. How come they became enlightened and we didn't? The reason is because, for one reason or another, that when they were hearing that sutta, their hindrances were abandoned. So they were really hearing it. Instead of hearing only some of it, And what you actually hear, what you actually gets filtered through, gets bent and strained and perverted. And so, unless you had no hindrances during when we were chanting that sutta, you didn't hear that sutta. You didn't hear what the Buddha was saying. You just filtered and changed, strained, took bits of it out, changed them this way and that one, that way, and spun them around. That's why they didn't work and didn't make you enlightened. So you really need to get these five hindrances out of the way. And then when you listen to a sutta, or you read a sutta, so often you can't actually finish it sometimes. My goodness, you just read a part of it, and wow, that's just so amazing. Just like a piece of concrete opens up to you. That's just a piece of concrete. Just imagine a piece of a sutta, a piece of Dhamma. My goodness, just that just makes you cry. Just so blissful, so powerful, so deep. It's a taste of liberation there. And when you actually start to taste that, my goodness, that's just so wonderful. Tasting without the hindrances. Which is one of the reasons why it's actually to get that deep insight of stream winning. It's one of the things is the words of another. Paratogosa is the cause for actually seeing the Dhamma. It's seeing what the Buddha saw. And the other cause is Yonisamanisikara. Work of the mind which goes to the source, which goes to the womb. It goes to the center of things, the heart of things, where things originate from. And to go in, this is what we mean by the origin of things. That's what yoni means. Work, that's just a very good literal translation, yoni samanasikara, not just wise attention, because it really doesn't say where the attention is pointed to. Wise attention. I mean, the literal meaning means which goes to the source of things, which goes to the womb. So we want to go to the womb of all things. And it's very hard to do that when you've got hindrances there, because they push you out, not in. Now, ill will and desire, they push you away from where you are. A restlessness, it never allows you to stay where you are. Sloth and torpor, okay, you are where you are, but you don't know where that is. And doubt was always moving you around. So to go to the source of things, you have to overcome those five hindrances. No desire, no wanting, no controlling. No ill will and complaining and moaning and about yourself, about somebody else, or about Dhamma, about the monastery. That's all ill will. That's a hindrance. No restlessness. No, shut up and be still. Stop. Stop. You know, don't run around. Just stop. Stop thinking. Stop moving. Stop complaining. Stop wanting. Stop trying to go somewhere. Be somebody. Stop. Get rid of the restlessness. And get that sort of brightness in the mind. A lot of the brightness actually comes from making merit. Having a wonderful lifestyle of purity, keeping your precepts and doing things for others. Because that's, you know, that's good karma. And good karma is like mental energy, brightness. So if you know one, a good way of overcoming sloth and torpor is actually going and doing something for others, making merit in the monastery, and then sort of using that merit, reflecting on it, and just allowing all the joy to come up in the mind. Again, I've told you before, that's one of the causes for my energy, not just doing things for others, but reflecting upon it afterwards. What have I done today? And then when I reflect upon all the good karma and all the service which I've given, and I just get so much energy back. That really brightens my mind. And that sort of overcomes the sloth and the torpor. And the doubt. Just suspend that. This, is it that? You don't know yet. Just shut up. Stop. When those hindrances are overcome, just for a few moments, again, then you can go to the source, because there's nothing pushing you away. The asavas, just in that chant, you know, they say they're free from the asavas. And those 1,000 monks, they finally completely liberated themselves from the asavas. Those asavas, it's like, it is that moving out from the source, out into the world, out into the future, out into the past. It's that which is the movement of the mind outwards. And the opposite of the asavas is going inwards. It's like yonisa manasikara. You know, this work of the mind which goes back to, goes to the source is almost like the opposite of asavas. The asavas is a stream, and when we go against the stream, that's the yonisa manasikara. It's going to the source rather than going outwards. And it's so difficult to do that. You can actually experience that in your insight practice. You're trying to get to the heart of things, but everything pushes you out. It's like sort of two magnets of opposite of the same poles trying to come together. The closer you get, the more is this repelling force. That repelling force is like the asavas, which push the mind out into the world, push it away from the center, push it away from, you know, the heart of things. But with the five hindrances abandoned, the asavas, that whole force, that current which takes you away from the center of things, is diminished until it's completely overcome. And then you can go inwards, you can get to the center of things. Not only can you get to the center of things in samadhi, and go to the center of the jitta, you know, go to the center of the body until the body's completely just fallen off the screen, go to the center of the mind, and get into nimittas, the center of nimittas, and go into jhanas, the center of jhanas, and go into cessation. You're always centering and centering and centering. That's why, to get into a jhana, you have to go against the stream of asavas. It's going the opposite direction. That's why, for many people, it's so difficult to do. You know, you get so close, and then you sort of get bent away, you get diverted, you get pushed away because of the stream of asavas, the current. You have to go to the center of things to get into the jhanas. That's why I always say, not moving on to something else, not getting the next thing, not getting rid of what you've got now. Those are all hindrances. They're all sort of defilements. Just stopping. Going in, calming, peace, stillness. Just not moving. And when you can actually do that, you understand also not just the way into deep states of meditation, but also the way to the deep states of insight. You want to find out what this mind is, what this lake is. You want to go to its center, to its heart, to its base. And when you do that, you actually find all these little fish which actually go in this lake called the jitta. And that's not the jitta, those are just the things which actually swim in it. You know, the piti sukha or the ekagata and all those sorts of things. They're just, you know, the swimming things in there. So you've got to see into that lake first of all. When you actually see into that lake, you go right to the very bottom of that lake. It's just emptiness. There's nothing there. But it's hard to see there's nothing there. And the closer you get to nothing, just the harder it is, you know, to come to that center. It's a huge repulsive force. You know, which stops you actually getting to the center of things. Because that repulsive force is the bhava dhanha, the craving to be, the craving to exist, the craving to have a self. And that's the most powerful of the cravings. And the closer you get to the center of things, then that's the force which dominates, which stops you seeing anatta, non-self. And that's why there's two causes for getting stream winning, which is seeing anatta, seeing fully into the center of things, seeing to the heart of things. It's a bhava dhanha, it stops. You get so close, and then bhava dhanha kicks in and stops you seeing any further. The craving to be, the craving to exist, the craving to have a self, which does, which knows, which is the craving to be. But eventually, when those hindrances are subdued, then you have the stillness to be able to go in. You've got the lack of the past and the preconditions, which stops you having an identity in those moments. You know, what an identity is, it's built upon past experiences, past views, past ideas. When there's no identity for those few moments, when you're in the present moment, really still, in deep meditation. That's, I think, the Sariputta said that. I thought the Buddha actually praised Sariputta that when he was in jhana, there was it no perception, I am in jhana? No perception of an identity at that time. I forget which sutta that's in, it's somewhere or other. There's no identity in those experiences because there's that stillness in the present moment. And you can't have an identity with that level of emptiness and non-duality of stillness in the jhana states. But by having that sort of stillness, you can go in. And you can get closer and closer and closer to the emptiness of a self. And Bawa Dhanha doesn't have a chance. You've got the strength, you've got the courage, you've got the stillness to see and to go more and more into the very, very center. It's like looking in a lake and eventually just going so deep into the lake, you actually penetrate it. You penetrate the jitta. You penetrate sort of the sense of knowing, of consciousness. You penetrate will. You go beyond, through, and see that the will is just something surface, just like a balloon. You know, it might look like it's something, but you go inside that, and you prick that illusion, the whole thing bursts. And you realize that I am not the one who's doing things. There is no doer. It's completely empty of a doer. The path is, but not the person who's walking on the path. And Nibbana is, but no one who enters it. And you penetrate to the knower, to consciousness. And that's all you need to do. Just penetrate those two things, will and consciousness, the doer and the knower. And of course, it's so hard to do because, you know, we think we are the knower. And how can we know the not knower? And how can we do non-willing? It just gets so complicated when you think about it. But the path of giving up the five hindrances and just following this way, you find eventually it just happens. With that stillness, the abandonment of the hindrances, you can actually look at the mind and just the attention just sinks in. Yonisamanasika, it goes to the source. Will is not the source. Consciousness is not the source. Those are just outer surfaces. You know, you've heard before my simile of the thousand petal lotus. Just every petal of that lotus has to open up just through maintaining your attention. And it's the nature of the lotus petals to open up when the heat of the sun warms the petals, and they open up one by one. The 1,000th petal, the 900th petal, the 800th, the 200th, the 100th, the 50th petal, and the 25th, 10th, 8th, 7th. When you get close, it becomes really weird, really strange, and also very scary. Because everything you've known before is completely, it's irrelevant. You're going into strange experiences, experiences where you can't, you've already almost got no existence, no knowing, no doing. And that's why many people can't go to the very center of the thousand petal lotus, just because Bawa Dhanha stops them. Karma Dhanha, sensory desire, that stops you getting through the outer few hundred petals. This Bawa Dhanha, the craving to be, stops you opening up the very central. Sometimes people think, the fifth petal, the fourth petal, it's so wonderful, so amazing, so weird. They think that's it. They think they're enlightened. They think now they know. But you stay still long enough, and then the last petal will open. And then you get to the very heart of the thousand petal lotus. You go through consciousness, you go through will, you go to the very bottom of the lake, of the citta, the very heart, the center, yoni samana sikara, the attention which goes, the work of the mind which goes to the very heart, the center of things. And that's where you see sunyata, nothing. There's nothing there. That similar I gave of the driverless bus, which was one of my favourite similes. All this life, you know, trying to find out who's responsible, and arguing and complaining sometimes that you transfer your ill will towards me, it's Ajahn Brahm's fault, or it's someone else's fault, or sometimes you transfer even, you know, your successes to me. Oh, thank you so much, Ajahn Brahm. There's no Ajahn Brahm here. Or you transfer it onto yourself. I'm terrible, I'm great, I'm a good meditator, I've had a good retreat, I've had a terrible retreat. Stop transferring onto things which don't exist. That's like, you know, you're going on a bus journey, sometimes it's things are lovely, you're looking through the window and it's just beautiful scenery, and you think, oh great. And you ask the bus driver to slow down so you can enjoy the scenery. Sometimes the bus driver slows down, more often than not it speeds up, so you can't enjoy yourself as long as you would like. Sometimes the bus goes through some really terrible scenery, toxic waste dumps. And you tell the bus driver, get out of here quickly. Sometimes the bus driver does speed up, sometimes he slows down, sometimes he even stops in the most unpleasant situations. So after a while you get so fed up with this bus driver, this will, you want to find exactly where this bus driver's seat is and go and sort them out, thinking that thereby you can control your bus, your life. Eventually you find the bus driver's seat, you walk up to the front of the bus where the bus driver sits, and there you find there's no one sitting in the bus driver's seat. It's a driverless bus. You go to the seat in your jitta where the bus driver sits, and you see there's no one there. And of course what happens after that? You just go back down, sit down and stop complaining. You stop craving, stop desiring. You know, there's no point when there's not a bus driver in the seat. Who are you going to complain to? You know, what's the point of craving? So this is actually the end of craving. When you go to the heart of things, see, there is no person doing the willing. There's no person doing the knowing. It's just an empty process, that's all. It's hard to get there when the hindrances are going. You can't get there when the hindrances are active. That's what stops you when you go to the centre of things. You know, through the abandonment of the hindrances, you've got the chance, the opportunity. And when you actually see those things, oh, it's such a relief to know you don't exist. You know, otherwise you have to do so many things, and life gets so complex. You know, whether you're good or whether you're bad, or whether you're successful or not successful, whether you do things right, you do things wrong. It's just such a mess, isn't it? You know, whether you're a good cook or you're a bad cook, you give good talks or bad talks or no talks, whether things are successful or not successful, whether you're healthy or whether you're sick, and whose fault it is. And that life is just such a burden when there's someone actually to blame. When there's no one in there, who can you blame? When there's just this knowing, it doesn't really matter, knowing nice things, knowing unpleasant things, it's just knowing, that's all, not me, nothing to do with the self. It gives you freedom, liberation, the problem is solved. You've seen what needed to be seen. You've seen there's no one in here, anatta, freedom. When there's a self in there, there's always going to be a problem. There's always a problem with the sense of me and mine. When there's no one in there, all problems stop there. And this is how you do it. You see it by going deeply inside. See, there's nothing there. When there's nothing in there, then you're set. You're okay. And that's freedom. And that's what this whole path is all about. And when there's no one in there, then you can really enjoy yourself until you're parinibbana and it's all gone and finished with. You've gone out in a sort of, with a nice finale. You've helped a few people. So that's actually what's before you. That's actually the path of serenity and insight, explained with a few similes. So, at the moment, don't trust your perceptions. Don't trust your thoughts. If you do, they'll create so much suffering. Don't trust your views, your understanding of the Dhamma, or understanding of Buddhism. If you're not an Aryan, a stream winner, you haven't got a clue. Maybe a little bit of a clue, but don't trust it. Trust silence, trust stillness, trust peace. What makes the mind quiet, what makes the mind bright, what makes the mind go in, that's the path, that's the way. Trust that much out of faith. And little by little you go deeper and deeper and deeper in. And when those five hindrances are gone, then you can trust what you see there, what you understand there. Then that's sort of view, perception and thought, which is free from the defilements, which is not warped anymore, which is not bent, which is actually truth. And that's how one knows, that's how one gains insight, and that's how one gains liberation. That's a little talk on insight this evening.
Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sanghaṁ Namo.